All right.
Yep.
A-Track's here.
Yep.
AJ just walked in. Hey, thank you for joining.
Pleasure.
I know you've been traveling a lot.
Yeah.
Or maybe normal amounts.
As it goes.
But you're here specifically for the Goldie Awards on Thursday, right?
Yes.
Before we even jump into you, can you talk about that a little bit? Because for people that don't know, because it's only the second year.
Yeah, sure. So I'm a DJ, and the start of my career was really jumped off by some DJ competitions that I won. So, you know, everything that I've done in the last 20 plus years, started with DJ battles. And it's a scene that in that time was really dynamic, you know, in the late 90s. Turntablism and the battle scene in particular had a lot of people's attention. My last battle was in 2000. In the time since then, I've done a bunch of other stuff that I'm sure we'll talk about. But, a few things kind of came full circle in the last couple of years where, in the meantime, DJing and, the world of producers got really popular, but battles themselves weren't really reconnected to that popularity of the scene. And to answer your question, the Goldie Awards is a new battle for DJs and producers that I've been organizing. I started last year. It's an annual thing. People have entered online, sending in videos and from around the world. And we selected 8 DJs for the DJ battle, 8 producers for the beat battle. We fly them out to New York. So Thursday in New York at Brooklyn Steel, there's this event where DJs and producers are coming in from around the world to battle, to compete. And the goal for me has been to sort of reconnect the dots between, you know, these incredibly talented DJs and producers who are active, and a lot of them are even sort of younger and on the come up, but for whatever reason, they don't always get the same amount of exposure as, some of the sort of main couple names that you keep hearing in DJing and beat making. The ones that are maybe a little bit more, you know, bedroom artists, but that have incredible skill and can really take out anyone when it's time to battle, they're not always the most famous ones. So the point of this project is to find, you know, the most talented.
I was going to say, like, how do you, because I'm sure there's like a huge ton of amazing DJs that are maybe trying to come up. How do you find those 8? I mean, I'm sure you have to call it down pretty far.
Yeah, we receive submissions. So, you know, a couple months ago when we announced the date for this year's event, we also put up all the instructions on the website, goldieawards.com, G-O-L-D-I-E, awards.com. You can still go there to watch videos, to familiarize yourself on what the event's about, and to get tickets because it's still open and it's happening in 2 days. So, but for about 2 to 3 months, I want to say 2.5 months, submissions were open. People could send in 1 minute videos. So they had to like really distill, you know, their tricks into 1 minute to catch our attention. And we got somewhere between 300 or 400 submissions from around the world. And that was really fun to just watch them. I would like, my management would send me like an updated Google Doc every Friday, you know, and at some point during the weekend I would watch.
You just like link to the videos and just watch.
Yeah,
them.
Just go through the videos and make little notes and, you know, eliminate a few and just keep, you know, anything that was sort of decent, just kept them in the running until the end. And at the end I had to go and watch everything again and like pick 8. It was hard to pick, you know. I would go back and you know, mark the ones that seemed like they were the best ones, and then I would still end up with like 40 or 50, and I'd be like, no, I need 8. This is not working, and go through it again. But that's the part, you know, people talk about curation a lot, and that was the part that was fun for me, because not only was I trying to pick individually DJs and artists and producers that had, you know, a certain level of skill, really awesome skill and originality and that stood out in some ways. But I was also thinking of the set of 8, like the the unit of those 8 together and what that would represent as a sort of platter on stage, and making sure that there was, you know, a variety of styles in that. Because, you know, you could sort of like get carried away and pick, you know, have like six of those eight DJs that end, that might be all super skillful but in a similar style. Okay. That's less interesting than having, you know, someone using this type of equipment, someone else using that type of equipment, you know, someone who's playing, you know, one that that specializes maybe more in like hip hop influence beats, whereas someone else is like on the techno vibe. And, you know, we got a producer from Venezuela who was just doing like dembow beats. And so just having that variety was really cool too.
Are you seeing, like you said, when you were getting known through battles 20 some odd years ago, are you seeing, just because I know shit all about DJing, like the submissions like this year, certain styles and trends that just weren't around? I mean, 20 years ago, obviously, that's a big thing, but even like last year or like a few years ago, we're like, oh shit, this is actually some new sounds.
There's between, you know, between last year and this year, there are a few trends that I noticed, but it's subtle. I think it's more in, you know, if you look at a few years at a time, you definitely see trends, whether it be like a certain type of technique that a lot of DJs might be doing. You definitely see, you know, the evolution of, you know, the sounds, I mean, songs themselves. Like there's, you know, there's trends in production, there's types of beats that are popular in any given year. So, you know, looking at entries from this year compared to last year, you know, there's certain songs that would come back a lot, but even certain tempos, you know, it can get as detailed as types of hi-hat programming that you hear a lot, that kind of stuff. Like people follow those trends. It's changed a lot since the years that I was entering battles, because music itself has changed so much. Sure. You know, I was competing in the mid to late 90s when, you know, it was definitely an underground hip hop scene, and you know, it was, and even into the early 2000s, I was still coming up with a lot of new, you know, battle type routines, these, you know, hyper technical, but also condensed and short, you know, routines where I would flip a record into, you know, a new kind of cut up version of it. But that was all still quite anchored in like boom bap hip hop. Right. And if anything, a lot of stuff I came up with in the early 2000s, I saw the sonics of music change. You know, when producers like Timbaland and the Neptunes were making, you know, really futuristic music, and I was jumping on those records a lot, and I was using a lot of Timbaland records in those years in my routines. You know, now obviously, you know, trap production is huge. You know, the electronic music has penetrated pretty much every other genre. So the sound has changed, but there's trends in the types of tricks that people do. I think anybody that knows a microculture or a subculture, there's comparisons to be made with turntablism. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I don't even know all that much about skating, but I know that there's a lot of comparisons to be made. Also, the fact that, you know, I grew up watching videos of scratch DJs, mm-hmm. and I learned a lot of my tricks just from watching videos of the greats, the same way that skate videos were a big thing in propagating, you know, just what it is that an artist does or a skater does. But there's also, you know, one of the things that's interesting to me is like there's eras where, you know, technicality is really in vogue, and there's other eras where it's just style and flow and like the intangible side of things. And that alternates. There'll be periods of a few years where technically new tricks are being innovated. You know, I remember watching one of those, 30 for 30, the ESPN documentaries on, I forget the guy's name, but the guy that won all the BMX championships. And, I was watching that and being like, wow, that's kind of like my run with turntablism where, you know, there's a period of a few years where there's so much innovation where, you know, the highest jump goes from X amount of feet to like, you know, 10 times that. And someone goes from doing two flips to six flips and that, you know, scratch DJing went through growth spurts like that too. And then there's other periods, 10 years can go by where like there isn't really a technique that is brought on that changes the game that much. But, you know, you start noticing people's style more and you start noticing people's individuality more in the way that they execute. So it's similar to that. But I mean, the thing that's fun with DJing and DJ battles is like at the end of the day, everyone listens to music, obviously. So there's a, you know, I still believe that there's a ton of people out there who might not realize just how much they would enjoy attending DJ battle, because there's something about it that comes across, maybe like a bit of a insider's vibe. Like it might feel a little bit insular, because you know, you might think like that it's all about like you know, look how fast my scratching is, but in fact, you know, you go in there and you watch, you witness someone play a record that you recognize, and then they flip it in a whole different way. And it surprises you, and like their energy, sometimes even their sort of, literally like someone's posture will engage you in a certain way. You know, the way that someone just carries himself on stage, and just, you know, like there's certain DJs, they their physicality, their physical language comes across like the turntables are literally extensions of their arms, and they just look like naturals. But there's someone else that might look like, you know, the Unabomber, and then you'd be like, who's this weirdo? And then they hit the decks and you're like, oh wow, like I didn't expect that. And that's super fun too. So those surprises are cool.
I can, as soon as you said the skating analogy, everything from that, I was like, oh, I get it. Like everything was really, I identify exactly like the goofy looking dude with crazy style, or like the really stylish dude that's not that technical.
Yep.
So that's amazing.
And there's always that one person that, you know, on a technical level, it'd be hard to explain why they're better than the others, but you see or hear them flow, and you're just like, yeah, this is just better. It's just better.
Do you think that growth of the innovation side, especially, I think when you were coming up, I guess, is that, do you think that was linked directly to having more battles in terms of people were really trying to up their game competitively?
I think in the years that I was getting into the battle scene, and with the growth spurts that happened around that, it's hard to, you know, there's a little bit of a chicken and the egg thing, or like a feedback loop where, you know, I don't know if it's because of the battles that the innovation happened so much, or is it because there was so much innovation that people, the battles were then interesting. Right? It really works both ways. But all I know is it was a point in time when, you know, undoubtedly a lot of new tricks were being developed, and it was capturing people's attention. Like, it's a trip for me to think back that, you know, I was world champion at 15 after scratching for 2 years.
I assume 15 is like crazy young.
Yeah, that record held until last year.
Really?
It held for 20 years. Yeah, yeah.
Someone did you meet that kid that beat you?
I haven't met him yet, but we spoke. He's Japanese. Nice. I mean, the guy that was second place in that battle that I won when I was 15, the guy was in second place. I think he was like 30 and had like 4 kids or something. So he saw, you know, someone half his age.
Yeah. It must have been like a sea change for him. He's like, all right, this is like something new coming up.
Yeah. I think he was probably like, what the hell?
I was like, fuck, I worked really hard.
Yeah. So, that era, I was just thinking like, it's a trip to think back at the attention that this scene, which in comparison to now was way smaller, right? Like there was no infrastructure for DJing. Like DJs barely had managers or anything. It was, you know, it was a very, you know, DIY, you know, one man band kind of operation. But still, the amount of attention that we all got from magazines and publications in the world at large from what was going on in these battles is pretty wild. Like I had an article in Interview magazine when I was like 16.
That's so nuts.
Just on some like,
that's
hey,
amazing.
this kid's winning a lot of cool stuff. And it's a trip to think back like later, years later, I remember thinking like, I was in Interview? That's dope. And at the time I didn't even, you know, I didn't compute half of what was going on. My brain was just thinking like, I must practice more. Like I was so focused on just that. And they'd be like, I have an interview tomorrow. That's cool.
It's going to take an hour out of my practice.
Yeah, exactly. Totally. And then years later, I'd be like, wow, there's some cool stuff that happened. You know, like, other magazines that would write about it. And I would get invited to perform at these really interesting, just sort of like cross-disciplinary kind of events, like very avant-garde kind of festivals. I remember playing this one show around like 1999 or so, or maybe 98. I think it was in 98. It was under the Brooklyn Bridge, I believe. And like myself and one or two other scratch DJs were performing, and then there was like live painting and like a Telequeli performance and all that. You know, just like, hey, come see some cool different...
Yeah, like a happening.
Yeah, right? And around the same, like that's maybe that same year, around the same time, there was in my hometown of Montreal, there was a very avant-garde kind of festival that happened where there was like I want to say it was probably like chamber music, you know, and then me scratching with some weird loop pedal, and they built a robot that was meant to, like, you know, those robotic arms that they use in like car plants, manufacturing plants. They tried to get this, like, you know, that kind of big arm robot to scratch a record. It's very
like
conceptual.
Right next to you?
Yeah. Literally, it was like man versus machine. So it's a trip to think at how scratching in those years was perceived as an avant-garde art form, and how many other subsets of people and other scenes just paid attention to it and would like invite my peers and I to mingle at interesting things.
So, I mean, you were saying you haven't done a battle since 2010?
Is that 2000. I stopped 2000? Battling a long time ago. Yeah, I battled in 97, 98, 99, 2000.
And then you kind of moved on after from battles.
Yeah, because it would take up like practically my whole year would be like coming up with material. It's like being an Olympic athlete. Mm-hmm. Like it becomes your whole life. You just come up with material to use at this one event.
So then what kind of prompted you to start it up again, or not start it, but like bring back a battle last year?
You know, it came from conversations kind of with my team, my management and stuff about like, you know, like my place in the DJ landscape is kind of unique. You know, like I'm really one of the few DJs that plays these massive festivals that scratches, period, if not the only one. Definitely one of the few. One of the few DJs that plays these big events that'll still request, you know, turntables at least some of the time. Like there's a part of my craft that, you know, you just don't see as much, but it's always been important for me for that those things that I do don't come across as old school, because I don't want to be like the artisanal guy,
the novelty guy.
Yeah, it's I always try to adapt scratching to the new sounds of music and to make it more, you know, modern sounding with the years, but still there's something that I bring to DJing that's different from what most DJs do. And you know, the DJ landscape became very crowded, and anything that I can do to kind of like flaunt what it is that I do that's different is interesting to me, or, you know, in a way that's less show-offy, and anything that I can do to use my perspective, right? Because I've seen DJing go from vinyl to digital, and I've straddled the lines between hip-hop and electronic music and back, and, you know, I could talk to Grandmaster Flash one day and like literally a 16-year-old rap producer the next day, and it's, you know, it's literally part of my days. So that reach and that perspective is something that I've come to realize is really special and precious to me. And you know, in the last decade or so, with the explosion of EDM, you know, turning DJ culture into such a mass thing, especially in North America. I think the rest of the world was up on big DJs, but North America really experienced it with this EDM boom that definitely slowed down in the last 2 years. The result of that, I think, is an awareness, but it's an awareness that was almost like underutilized. Mm-hmm. It was a very surface level awareness. People know DJs, they know names. They'll be like, oh yeah, that person made that song on the radio, or I saw this person on the cover of a magazine. But what I sensed was room for curiosity. You know, like we could sort of like draw the curtain, pull the curtain back and say, all right, now that we have your attention and that the flashy stuff is a little bit less in vogue, let's get into like the serious stuff and just show other DJs that might not be on the cover of a magazine, but that are truly more skilled.
Right.
To use that awareness for you know, to showcase DJs and producers that are that deserve it and that are doing amazing things.
I mean, especially like you mentioned, the kind of like showing their skills, or there's a lot of like tricks. Even you said that, like the DJs are kind of inventing now and coming up with.
Mm-hmm.
Do you? I mean, obviously you have a really busy event and like performance schedule. Mm-hmm. I imagine nonstop. But do you ever get much of a chance to actually try new things without the pressure of performance anymore?
I would say I like the pressure of performance, and the pressure of performance is probably the thing that still keeps me on my toes to come up with new material. If I have certain shows, you know, that I think would be a good opportunity for me to go and, you know, isolate a few days of practice time and come up with a bunch of new tricks that I know I can use at shows for months after that. You know, that's usually during the year. I'm DJing many nights a week, every week. And there's a lot of stuff that I freestyle in my sets, and I definitely have a comfort level where I could just, you know, come up with more than half the set on the spot and grab a part of a record and scratch it and do, you know, do things that aren't rehearsed that reflect my style. But there are certain types of tricks that do require a certain amount of, like, brainstorming and sitting at home and trying different things and, you know, programming a few parts that will allow me to do something even more intricate. So I'll pick out a few shows during the year that'll be like the shows that I practice for.
Oh, that's cool.
You know? So there was a thing that I did last week that was really geared for the DJ community. It's on a website called DJ City, where they get DJs to come and do a streaming set. So it's video streamed, and it's an audience of DJs that are watching, you know, a DJ do a streaming set. So, you know, when I had that coming up last week, I thought, all right, this is a show where I should really take a little bit of time before to come up with some new tricks. And
I know I know a lot of your Instagram posts are the videos of you practicing at home. Is that your at home?
Yeah, that's at home. Yeah, on my Instagram, I post videos of like quick little 1 minute ideas. Yeah. I like to put myself in a position where I force myself to come up with something, either because I've announced that I'm going to film it, or because there's a show where I know that, you know, a specific type of crowd is going to be watching my every move, and I'm like, all right, I got to come correct for this one. Like that's almost the only way that I still take the time to come up with new tricks. But I love that because ever since I've started filming these little videos, you know, in my practice room at the house and posting them on my Instagram, you know, I have to keep it going. So no matter what deadlines are going on, and no matter what's going on with my other projects and Fool's Gold and traveling and jet lag and real life things and having to fix a leak at the house or whatever, I'll be like, I told myself that I would post a video this week. That means I need one afternoon to practice to come up with an idea, and then the next day I film it. So no matter, you know, half the house might be on fire, I'm filming this.
We'll put out that fire afterwards.
Yeah, and not only am I filming it, but it means like I must come up with a new idea, one that's good enough because people are going to watch the video and they'll critique it.
I mean, that's an amazing thing, especially starting as young as you did, to maintain that kind of personal push for 20 plus years.
Yeah, no, thanks. And I think there's, you know, there's probably certain years where I was pushing myself a little bit less on that end, because, you know, there's pros and cons to being like, to having a style of DJing that's different from everybody else's. You know, there's also a point where I realized that most audiences probably wouldn't see the difference if I was doing a new trick or a trick that came up with 5 years ago. They would just be like, oh, he scratches, that's cool. So, you know, if that was during a period where I was trying to meet certain goals on the remixing side or on whatever other things that I might be doing, or again, Fool's Gold or whatever else, like any of my other projects, there's definitely periods where I wasn't pushing myself as regularly to come up with new tricks on the technical DJ side. I felt like I could coast off of what I had for a little while. And then in recent years, I just sort of came back to it and thought, you know, this is my identity. And also I got excited about it again. And I just started making a point to come up with these ideas more regularly. And part of what got me excited about that process again is also advancements in technology, because there's new pieces of equipment that came out that had, you know, new buttons to it. My setup for the longest time was two turntables and a mixer. And for years and years and years, I loved even just the idea that I have a limited amount of tools, and it's, you know, I have to come up with new things constantly to do with only those two turntables and that mixer. And I think after like many years, there was a point where I felt like there wasn't really anything more that I could do with with those limited tools. I mean, I like that idea in general. Like, you know, you can compare that to painter or whatever else. Like, you're using this brush, those four colors. That's all you're allowed to do.
Right.
But there's a point where you run out of stuff. And with new technology adding, you know, new possibilities to my tools in the last, let's say, 3 years or so, that, you know, there's like a something that was dormant in me that woke up again that said, oh boy, let's play toys, you know? And it's cool because there's things that weren't possible before that were suddenly at the touch of a button. So the imagination goes crazy.
I mean, related, I guess, in some way to having suddenly new things to play with or trying new things.
Yeah.
I know, like, Goldie Awards started last year, mm-hmm. and Fool's Gold Records just hit its 10-year anniversary also last year, right?
Yes.
I know you guys now do the festival. Yeah. I'm just kind of curious, like, let's in the past, even just, I mean, 10 years is actually quite a long time, but what things did you kind of push that were not quite in your singular line of being DJ, A-Track the DJ, that you were like, let's try something new, let's start something new?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, look, the first 10 years of my DJing, you know, to, like, I won my first big championship in 97, and you could say that from 97 to 2007, you know, roughly, was primarily one path. I mean, those last couple of years, 2005, 6, 7, I was starting to experiment with what I'm going to get to now. But for the most part, it was, you know, hip-hop DJing rooted in turntablism. And there was definitely some entrepreneurial things that were going on along the way. My brother Dave and I had an early record label back in Montreal when we were younger. And, you know, we learned how to approach the DIY way of doing things and pressing our own vinyl and, you know, doing things that we weren't trained to do and figuring out that it's not that hard. But for the most part, it still felt like kind of a straight line. And I think the second decade of my career feels like where a lot of things blossomed in different directions. You know, by the mid-2000s, around the same time that I started touring with Kanye, because I started working with him right after College Dropout came out. So from 2004 to the end of 2007, early 2008, for those 4 years, I toured with him. As that was going on, even then there was big changes in technology where everything became digital. Using digital files kind of expanded my access to way more music. I got into different genres. I fell in love with electronic music. I got into mashups. But also, you know, right from my early Kanye tours, I started writing a blog about my travels. Mm-hmm. And like the Fader would post my little travel journals about, like, well, you know, today we played, you know, at the Grammys, and this is what the rehearsals was like. And, you know, there was this big, whatever, argument at rehearsals because we wanted to do this idea, and they said no, and blah, blah, blah. And then people would read that and be like, whoa, you do all these things? Like, they knew that I was on tour with this famous rapper, but they didn't realize that, like, half an hour before hitting the stage, we're all backstage editing instrumentals, you know, copying files onto whatever machine and, you know, getting on, performing on TV with no rehearsals and all that kind of stuff. So that writing about what I was doing, you know, felt like it was, you know, an expansion in one direction, because it made the narrative more explicit. Around the same years, I was like moving to New York. I befriended a few people that were doing cool new things in the sort of downtown scene. Then next thing you know, I'm making a t-shirt with that person, you know, the sort of collab thing. Fool's Gold was born in that setting too.
I was curious, just at that point, why did you decide to start Fool's Gold?
Well, so...
Or how did that start, like, happen?
Yeah, Fool's Gold was born out of, on one hand, a friendship between myself and Nick Catchdubs, who's a DJ from New York, who was also into graphic design and had this really cool blog, catchdubs.com. A lot of people were reading that blog at the time. It was so cool that when the fader decided to, you know, crack the code of like what's a magazine's website supposed to be? It's a trip to think back that there was a point in time when magazines didn't have websites, or the website was just like,
or had no idea what to do about it.
Yeah. So they went and hired the guy that had a good blog, and that was Nick. So Nick became one of the music editors at the fader, but on the strength of his blog. And so I befriended this guy, and we were like trading a lot of music right from when we first met. And so that was going on one hand. The sound of the music around us was changing a lot. You know, hip hop was sort of ripe for experimentation, and like a lot of our friends and myself were messing around with like different tempos and using like a little bit more of like a club friendly, you know, upbeat electronic approach to tracks that would have a featured rapper, whereas rap was at the same tempo for years and years before that. So new energy, you know, and taking the sort of like mashup mentality and applying it to original music, that was going on too. So the sound itself was changing, and it was starting to be driven by DJs. And the DJs who had cool parties in their respective cities and who were making cool mixtapes and just coming up with interesting ideas of blends and, you know, new types of production, they were behind, they were championing music that you know, felt like the future, really.
You said this was around like 2007.
Yeah, yes. And, you know, I was producing a new rapper from Chicago called Kid Sister. And then, you know, we're sitting on these records and we weren't sure if we should try to like get her signed, but the majors didn't really get it yet. Major labels were too busy fumbling with how to handle the download age, because all the Napster stuff was like right before that. So these big corporations that were essentially the major labels couldn't figure out how to adapt themselves to the digital age, went from years of extreme prosperity to suddenly losing a ton of money because people were ripping albums and you know, sharing them on LimeWire and whatever else. So they were too busy trying to figure out how to like not see their entire operation crumble to realize that music was changing. And so, you know, Nick and I just felt like there, you know, between ourselves and our little group of friends, there was a bunch of people making really interesting music, and someone had to put it out. And someone had to not only put it out, but do it in a way that would do it justice to just how cool and creative that era was, and, you know, have the right ideas of like how it should look, who should be who should be the featured guest, the remixer, this and that, like how to package these ideas, thinking just as much of, you know, what are these little, almost like these little hooks that can go and grab other people's attention, but also thinking about posterity. Like on one hand, like, oh, if we get this person to remix it, then that DJ will pay attention to it. So sort of like same timeline kind of thoughts, but also like, man, let's make something for the ages. Yeah. You know, let's package this a certain way that, you know, even in 10 years, we'll look back at it.
And was Kid Sister the first artist you put out?
Yeah. Cool. So her music was kind of the impetus to launch Fool's Gold. Dave, my brother, who you know, was doing Chromeo, his band, at first sort of on the side for a while, but around those years it was starting to pick up a little bit. So he was kind of busy with his band, but he was also he had moved to New York before me, so he was kind of helping me navigate New York, which I had just moved to. And so he was seeing kind of some of these new connections that I was making, and he was kind of helping me figure out like what to make out of it. So he loved the idea of starting a new label too. And we brought in Dust LaRock, a brilliant illustrator and art director, to do all the art direction for Fool's Gold. Rest in peace to Dust, but he played a huge role, especially in the first 5 years of the company. So Fool's Gold was born out of the ashes of the record industry falling apart, but at the same time, out of this incredible period of creativity, where, you know, DJs and bedroom producers were connecting on MySpace and, you know, coming up with new sounds that broke a lot of rules in a fantastic way. And, you know, we sort of set out to put a stamp on that and be the label for that.
I mean, it's interesting with the bunch of the guests. There's a, like, that moment where everything around you is sort of falling apart. And a lot of it happens around the recession.
Yeah.
Is where people are like, there's nothing else to do, so I started something, or something needed to be done.
Yeah.
Or nobody was doing X, so I was like, let's just do that ourselves.
Right.
And it's amazing.
And we're 10 years removed from that, so it's cool to see the
now
seeds
that
were planted.
Now it's like coming to fruition. Yeah, sure.
Exactly.
It's actually really nice that, like, actually there was a lot of positive things that came out of whether the recession or the music industry having no idea what to do about streaming, like all this stuff.
Yeah.
Did you ever have a sense? I mean, the other side of that is also, like, there's no, obviously, there's no guarantees that any of this stuff's going to work in terms of when you start something new.
Yeah.
Certainly at the beginning of, and I'm asking this kind of like, because you've already had at this point 10 years in of a very successful career as a DJ. Did you feel any kind of concern or excitement that, oh shit, this is actually a risk, Fool's Gold Records, like this may not actually pan out? Or you're like, actually, we got this. This is actually.
It was exciting because you can sense when something's bubbling, you know? Like, I think a big part of sort of playing your cards right through the years and ensuring longevity is, you know, learning how to identify some of these key moments where it's time to just like drop everything and dive in, right? So, you know, a big part of it is having a skill set and you know, feeling prepared and you know, being able to show and prove, whether you're a designer or a DJ, musician, artist, whatever, like really being on top of your game on any given day is part of it. But another part of it, I think, is just knowing how to identify those moments and being like, this feels like it's worth me investing, you know, a decent amount of my time to plant a new seed or to, you know, to start a sort of a bit of a new path, you know? The same way that when I was entering these competitions when I was really young, there was no real precedent for someone being that young going into competitions, but I felt on top of what I was doing. I felt ready, or at least ready enough. And I just sort of dove in, and that definitely paid off. But on the Fool's Gold side, and like you were saying, being 10 years in and sort of taking a risk, the way that I remember that is that, in fact, a lot of what I had built for those first 10 years was part of a scene that was already losing steam. So I could see, I would look to my left and look to my right and see, you know, the wave that I was a part of and that I was riding that was already starting to lose steam. So I knew that there was something, there was a new play that had to be made. And I wasn't trying to slow down. I still had, you know, just that fire in me. So I wanted to do more. I knew there was something new that had to happen. And starting Fool's Gold really wasn't that much of a risk, to be honest, because we didn't get like investors or whatever, what have you. Like, we didn't have to answer to anyone. Mm-hmm. We started it. We slowly built a snowball. We started it off of, you know, pretty conservative conservative numbers, pressing a few records and you know, making a quantity of a product that we knew we could sell through, and with the sales of that, reinvesting into the next thing and then into the next thing. There's literally no capital needed to start. I think all it was that we picked out our first couple releases that connected. So everything that we were making for that first year or two was just coming back. Because then year two, next thing you know, we spot Kid Cudi, we put out Day and Night. Right. Like, there's things like that just like really gave us a good return on investment. And we were able to keep going with no investment for a long time. So we didn't have to answer to anyone, and we didn't have to worry about potentially losing much, as long as we were smart with our decisions. And we definitely weren't always smart. There's definitely times where we lost, but at least we tried to learn from that.
I think there's also something there with, and again, this is actually just, I'm only touching this because a bunch of guests sort of alluded to it as well, was when they take what otherwise seems like that big leap, and oftentimes it is that big leap.
Yeah.
It's at the time not frightening because they're it's almost like, what do I have to lose? And mm-hmm. in a weird way, it's like, even if you have a lot to lose, it's actually, it's yours to lose. You're comfortable with it.
Yeah.
You're not in the pocket of someone else. You're not like, shit, if I lose this, I'm kind of fucked because I have other people to answer to in that sense.
Yeah.
But I feel like that's really important kind of takeaway is like, put that risk in, but actually be very, weirdly, it's like, if you're kind of holding all the cards, you actually don't have to worry that much in a weird way. It might not work, but somehow like you have sort of say in terms of what not work kind of looks like.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that's important to think about in that respect is like, you know, now I think we're in an era where starting your own business endeavor or brand or, you know, being self-employed is probably less scary than it was 10 or 15 years ago. There's more and more people that, you know, put creative director on their Instagram bio and that's what they do, or start some sort of brand. And I love that the entrepreneurship is accessible. Mm-hmm. People feel like there aren't these sort of gatekeepers anymore. But I do think that, you know, one, not everyone has to go that route. There's nothing wrong with just being someone's assistant or someone's manager or just being part of the team, or going to work into the corporate side of things, but trying to change the way things work there. Like, it, you know, I feel like the entrepreneur is a little bit over glorified nowadays. And the key thing that I think is sometimes overlooked is that if you are going to go that route, it's important to have an idea, a point of view, a sense of what it is that you stand for and what your company or brand or musical project stands for. If you don't have an actual point of view, there's no real point in doing it. And it doesn't have to be perfectly figured out right from the start. If you have enough of a sense of it, you can sort of like just dive in and build it as it goes. But I think it's at least important to have these moments of like self-reflection and think, you know, does this project that I could take on, does this feel like me? Is this part of, does this make sense with other things that I've done?
Right.
And, you know, is there a bigger picture that I'm building, or am I just chasing something that I saw someone else do?
Yeah.
You know, because what's wild is also seeing, on some real life shit, it's also kind of wild seeing, you know, in a sense, kind of a generation of people who took a lot of risks 10 years ago. You know, we don't talk about the ones who, for whom it's not really working out now, who are 30 something and who are sort of like, yeah, I'm not sure what I want to do with my life now. Mm-hmm. And like, I don't want to put too much emphasis on that because I know this podcast is here more to like,
no, but it's important to know.
Yeah, but it's important to look at the cautionary tales and be like, well, what's the difference between that case where it didn't pan out and this case where someone is just still building and thriving year after year? You know, I think a lot of times the scenarios that work well, you'll find a real sense of purpose and idea and point of view in those cases, combined with a good sense of like a keen sense of who's a good partner, you know, who to work, like just these good instincts of who's a good person to associate with, who has your best interest in mind, who's not going to double cross you,
right.
you know, and also, you know, when to say yes, when to say no.
Right.
Like there's all those things that even once you dive in will make the difference between the path that we all strive for and the stuff that just doesn't really work out.
I mean, especially like when you were talking about having that point of view and actually, and we, I think once you have that point of view and actually the experience of kind of running your own life or business in a way, like that kind of second 10 years of the career you're talking about, it seems like that's when you started really pushing initiatives and ideas and things like, I think this is important, I want to put this out, I think this is important, I want to start this thing.
Exactly. And there's so many things that came with doing Fool's Gold that put me in positions where, you know, business positions that I never thought I'd be in, whether it be, you know, being CEO of an independent company with no training in business whatsoever, but just hopefully just a little bit of common sense and also some good mentors, between that, but like even you know, we worked together on the shop, and that was Fool's Gold's second shop. If you went to 15-year-old me who was just scratching obsessively and said, one day you'll have a store, you'll run a festival, you'll do this.
Like,
I'd be like, what? How? Like, I was studying physics. Huh. I was a physics major. It kind of makes no sense to think that I'm now doing these things, but, you know, if anything, maybe I was studying physics because I really liked physics, you know? And now I'm doing these things because I really like those things. Like, there's nothing that I do that is because someone else did it.
Yeah.
It comes from within, and I think that's important.
I mean, it's funny because, like, I think I would imagine it sounds like when we talk to them, but like every person that's come in, regardless if they're 20 years in or they're 3 years in or they're just achieved something or they're kind of on their way to try to do something.
Yeah.
Whatever the cases are, everybody's very happy, like super proud of what they do, super stoked on what they do.
Yeah.
Would not really want to be doing something else.
Yeah.
And however you measure success, like at the very least, it's like these people are doing what they want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that feels like huge, because obviously not everybody gets to do that.
Yeah.
And not everybody kind of like runs after that.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I would even say, like, it's okay to sometimes not be happy, and it's okay to, like, fail also. Like, I think a big part of working through these lessons is actually looking at the lessons themselves. You know, like, definitely the biggest lessons that I've had in life came from failures. Mm. And just from being okay with falling down and trying to figure out how to get back up how to get back up in a way that you know, hopefully doesn't recreate the same fall again.
Yeah. Was there something that you tried to pull off, like whether a new endeavor, an initiative or something that did not work?
For
that
sure.
You could talk about?
Yeah. I mean, even at the very beginning of my battling career, right? So I won this one championship when I was 15, and like we were saying earlier, like there was something kind of uncanny and unlikely about, you know, a particularly young looking, you know, Canadian team from, like, there had never even been a Canadian DJ that made it to the finals of this of the DMC competition, let alone win it, you know. And hip hop kind of being what it is, and me being just white Jewish middle class kid, like it was unexpected. And you know, there's definitely there was plenty of DJs in the scene who doubted me. Mm. You know, and I had to face haters early on and kind of like figure out how to build thick
skin. As a 15-year-old.
Yeah. As a 15-year-old who was kind of shy also, and just kind of like work out how to navigate that. And my master plan was, it's cool, I got this. I'm gonna defend my title the next year, because when you win these championships, you automatically get to be in it again the next year. And I was like, I'll win 2 years in a row, and then no one's going
to
be able to
say easily.
Yeah, and then they can't say shit. Of course I didn't win the next year. But the year after that, I won 3 titles. Huh. So, you know, losing that second year was a huge bummer and a big blow to my ego, and it definitely, you know, messed up my master plan. But I think in hindsight, I'm glad that you know, I didn't let that hold me down too much. And then I thought, like, all right, well, what can I do better next year? Maybe I won't put all my eggs in one basket. Maybe I'll enter a few of these things. Maybe I'll, you know, sort of even just review my set in a different way, try to make sure that it's more foolproof. So learning those lessons. And even just in more recent years with Fool's Gold, like when we started Fool's Gold Day Off, there was no event that was comparable to it for a few years. Mm. Because rap was going through, hip-hop was going through such a transition phase, and rappers weren't playing on festival stages yet. You had, and there was a ton of new rappers who were, you know, building this new movement and changing the sound of hip-hop and, you know, creating a culture with it at the same time. And we were one of the few events that would just put them on a stage. In the first couple of years, it grew bigger, bigger year after year. It was like incremental growth for X amount of years. Of course, there's a year where we took a loss after that, you know, and that we took a big loss 1 year. And, you know, we just had to sort of figure out what we did wrong and what was changing around us. Hmm. I think for a while we would just sort of like figure that if we kept growing our own perspective, what we're doing, but from a sort of self-contained way, that we could make this operation grow. But I think it's also important to look at the climate around you. You know, if there's if you're suddenly not the only person offering something, or if I don't know, just if demand changes for whatever reason.
Can we talk about that? I guess it's 98 loss.
Yeah, sure.
I don't, it's a while ago, so I don't know if you remember all the details of it, of course. But
I definitely do. I remember all of it.
But the reason I wanted to talk about it is, one, I feel like it'll be kind of entertaining, but yeah, mainly because I think it's one thing to hear, all right, A-Track failed, but actually, you know, next year he was on top of it again. From there, it was like smooth sailing, which obviously there's lots of bumps along the way.
Yeah.
But I think it's, I can imagine it's nice to hear what it was like in that moment of like, oh, fuck. Like, did you know as you were on for your last set, did you know that you weren't going to win? Do you remember that?
I knew that something felt off. There's a few things that happened. So the DJ who won is this guy called Craze, who I ended up befriending, and we actually worked together a lot after. He was from the U.S. I was this battle, that year, the world finals were in Paris. It was in France. And it was in a big venue, like, I want to say 5,000 people, big venue.
Where was the 97 one at?
Italy.
Okay.
In those years, it would be in a different country every time. And so we were in France, and most of the other DJs were European. And Craze and I, even leading up to the battle, we all flew out a day or two before. We were hanging out before the battle. We didn't really know each other well prior to that, but we got to Paris and we sort of got to hanging out. And we're like, all right, we are sort of kindred spirits here. You know, we even had this little bonding moment the night before the competition where I had turntables set up in my hotel room to practice, of course. And there was a bit of a, like, I'll show you mine if you show me yours moment, where we showed each other our little routines. And, you know, we went in there just thinking, like, all right, like, one of us has to take this. And
so at that point, obviously, like, you don't know that you're going to come up against each other in the final. Like, what's the format of that competition?
So, you know, I want to say a month or two before, each country that participates in, we're talking about the DMC Championship, there's branches in like 30-something countries. They each have their finals, you know. So I knew that Craze won the USA final something like 2 months before, and that he was going to be in the World Championships basically against me. But I didn't know all that much about him. I was definitely hearing some hype, but, you know, I was just also extremely focused to go in there and win again. So we get to Paris and we started hanging out, and I felt like I had, you know, a kin there. And yeah, that competition was in a big room. That event was in a big room where the sound was kind of boomy. And sometimes it's a little harder to command, you know, energy in that kind of big boomy room. And he was one of the last contestants. You know, it's kind of one after the other. Everyone does their, in this case, it's a 6-minute set. He was one of the last ones. And there was the French DJ, actually, who went on a little bit before him. And it, he went on, and he did this thing that was really amazing. Like, he deserved to win. And then I was the last contestant because I was the defending champion. And we both felt like the sound was, like, maybe a little bit less loud.
You and Craze?
Yeah. I remember we were both like, hey, are we paranoid? Or, like,
think they were, like,
after the French DJ, did they, like, go and, like, mess with our volumes a little bit? But it was just tough to tell because it was a big room. But I was up there doing my set, and I had, like, some equipment problems. And this is, like, an extremely intricate performance. Yeah. It's like, if, like, compare it to figure skating, right? Like, it's as,
like, decimal point kind of level.
Yeah. And just in terms of, like, if one thing goes wrong, it messes, like, you don't even have time to fix it or whatever. There's a knob on my mixer that flew off in the middle of a thing. And, like, I think at the same time, the needle skipped on my record, and I was like, oh shit. And I found the knob, and I was able to, like, put it back on,
like,
the thing.
Like, on the ground?
Yeah, I don't remember if it fell onto the mixer or on the ground, but I definitely, like, there's a video of this, of me putting this piece back onto the crossfader and figuring out where to get back to the part of the record I was using. But, I mean, that definitely, like, that's like if you, if, again, to use the figure skater analogy, it's like falling, mm-hmm. right? Like fell on the floor and I had to get back up and be like, oh, where was I in my spin here? Pun intended. And so between that and the sort of like weird volume thing, I was like, man, I'm not sure. And yeah, they there was even another weird thing where they announced him as the winner, and then they said that myself and the French DJ, who was the local guy, on the at the event, they said that we tied for second place. And then the next day when they announced the results, they put me in third. And I was like, well, hold on a second. And there's, you know, when you, I think when you go out into the field and like sort of like take a swing at something, there's, you know, you don't have full control over the circumstances. Mm-hmm. You don't have full control over how certain things are going to be interpreted or even the way that people will even see or hear what it is that you're doing. And there's always, you know, you can, you could stay and get hung up over like, well, I feel like the volume was the, who knows? I mean, we, you know, that's what a couple people told us that night, that that they mess with our sound, but I don't know. And there's no way to go back and tell. And that's besides the point. And what's done is done. So, you know, I think you could look at it with, you know, with a sort of like, it wasn't totally my fault kind of approach, or you could just sort of dust it off and be like, all right, that didn't go obviously as I planned because I didn't win this thing. But what ended up happening was Craze and I formed a crew together. And we set out to conquer the world in the following years. And yeah, like I mentioned, the following, the next year in 99, rather than putting all my eggs in one basket and spending like literally like the whole year preparing for this one decisive moment, I was like, I'm going to enter everything. And I won a bunch of stuff and it was, you know, it paid off. And
sure, very validating too.
Yeah, it was validating. And I felt like I sort of like got, I got the wind back in myself.
Were you nervous the first competition you...
That I went back into?
After, were you nervous like a knob was going to fly off again?
No. I mean, because in the meantime, I was doing other shows and like, you know. When you perform a lot, there's... It's like it's a game of statistics. Like something's going to go wrong at some of them. And like the odds that that thing that goes wrong will happen... The odds that that'll happen at a battle where everything again, is decisive... Yeah. Who knows? Like it could happen, but chances are it probably won't.
Right.
You know, things won't go wrong more than once, kind of thing. So,
so at that point, when you're 15, 16, 17,
yeah,
obviously top of the kind of DJ world.
Yeah, starting to get to that point. Yeah.
Were you, because obviously you were still a kid,
yeah,
were you already at that point thinking, I can make a career from this? Like, this is what I, not that you want to do this for the rest of your life, you probably did, but like, that it was, it could be a viable thing to make a living from?
At that point in time, the other thing that's a trip now is once in a while I go through my storage and I still have like some of the interviews that I did.
No
then.
Way.
It's funny to read like when someone will be like, where do you see yourself in 10 years? And I'll be like, you know, I'm in school. And da-da. At that point in time, I didn't, it was hard for me to think that this would be like a full-on career, like something. And even, I feel like, you know, my parents were cool with me doing this stuff. My mom would sometimes travel with me, you know, until I was like 17 or 18. Definitely when I was 15, 16, either my brother or my mom, one of them would travel with me for shows or competitions. But as far as like the parental advice, they were happy that I found something that was, you know, that I found my voice in a sense. I found something that was unique to me. And that was working for me. But I do think that there were still some conversations along the lines of, look, this stuff is great. Have fun with it. You got to also keep your grades up. Because I was a good student. And like they didn't, my dad didn't want, my dad's a sort of agreement with me was, you can do this stuff if your grades don't right. slip. And sort of along that same train of thought, sometimes my dad would say, you know, you'll probably be able to do this for a couple of years. I'm not sure what things will be like when you're 40.
Right.
So you should still, yeah. you know, continue
Let's
in
get
school.
That physics degree.
Exactly. which went into the physics degree. You should still continue school and like, you know, you could sort of like figure that out with time. So in those years when I was doing those battles and I was getting to a point of notoriety where I was getting booked for shows and I was starting to get paid a little bit for a few shows, nothing compared to what DJs make now, mm-hmm. but something, like there was demand. Mm-hmm. And, you know, from the point that I was multiple time world champion, you know, that feels like something that people will continue booking for at least a couple of years. I still would say that I was gonna, that this was, it was like a very serious hobby or very serious passion. I work on it every day. I had very clear goals of like the next couple of things I wanted to accomplish, whether it be like, all right, now it's time for me to make my first mixtape, or, you know, I need to come up with a new set for this show that's in 2 months. That I had like short-term goals. And in those years, my long-term goals were still just within the realm of battles. Like, I want to take that title and that title. Beyond that, there was this sort of a little bit more unknown sense of, I'm still in school. I don't know beyond 5 years where this will take me. So let me get some sort of backup plan.
Were there guys at the time or people at the time, especially in the kind of scratch DJ world, that were professional? Thank you. Professional full-time scratch DJs were like, oh, okay, there's actually, like, that you saw, like, oh, that's some guy doing it, whether I want to do it or not, but it's possible.
Yeah, but that scene was changing really fast, too, so it was a little tricky to, see where the whole scene was going to go in the next couple of years. But I was really lucky to meet my heroes, my idols, the year that I won that first championship. A lot of them were the judges in that battle.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So there was a whole generation that really innovated a lot right before me, won a bunch of world titles, and then they all kind of got out of battling around the same time. I came in right after them. So I learned a ton from watching their videos, and the fact that they all kind of got out of battling around the same time, and they were all like maybe 6-7 years older than me. One, it kind of opened up a lane for me to go and start winning stuff. But two, I met them, and they were particularly cool with me, like receptive to me. And like a lot of them took me under their wings. And, you know, in hindsight, you can call that mentoring. And I think that gave me a sort of optimism that I ran off of that. Like I functioned off of, you know, the fumes of that optimism for a long time, just to be like, this is such a cool scene. The DJs that I learned from indirectly, but still learned from their videos and idolized, are so cool, and like I can aspire to be like them. Like there wasn't much disillusionment of like, oh damn, this guy's a jerk. You know, I think that fueled me a lot, because it definitely gave me something to aspire to. And these were DJs who, yeah, had stopped battling and were doing other interesting projects. Some of them were getting record deals, you know. Some of them were getting brand sponsorships. So, yeah, I was able to look at them and be like, I want to be like them.
Yeah. Was there a moment, obviously, because you'd already set getting a name for yourself with winning all these world championships and battles. Was there a moment soon after that where like, oh shit, this is actually what I will be doing because I want to do it for the rest of my life, in terms of a, like, physics sort of dropped out of the picture? You're like, all right, this is what the focus is now. I can do this.
The physics thing kept going for a little while. I definitely remember when I stopped. And like a lot of times when there was like long-term decision conversations, that would be like a brainstorm between me and Dave. Huh. Even though Dave was in those years in a different scene from me, you know, he was always kind of my coach, even when I was first trying to scratch.
That's incredible.
Yeah. No, it was. I was lucky to have him around right from the start, where he saw me try to scratch, you know, on my dad's record player, and identified something there. It was like, you should practice every day after school, because there's no one that I know that can do what you're doing, and you know, this could lead to some incredible things. So, like, make sure you come home.
How old was he at that time?
He was, he's 4 years older. So when I was 13, he was 17.
I mean, that's a good insight from
Yeah. It's very wise for a 17-year-old. Yeah. So he would coach me, and he would, you know, watch my practice. And he was just a guitar player then, but he had a musical ear. Huh. So he could still tell what sounded good or bad. Or, by the way, when you're 17 in Montreal, you're going out to clubs. Like, yeah, that's what Montreal's like. So he was actually seeing DJs. I was trying to be a DJ, having never seen a DJ in the flesh. Dave was going to clubs, hearing DJs, and then he would watch me practice and be like, that doesn't sound like what a DJ does. Huh. And he might not be able to verbalize or break down the intricacies of what I'm doing wrong with the trick, but he'd be like, nah, that's not it. And I'd that's be amazing. Like, ah, damn. And then I would practice until I could figure it out. And he would watch the next day and be like, yeah, that's what that thing sounds like.
Let me go to the club, take some notes for you.
Yeah. So already early on, he was doing that. And, you know, at those key points of my career, when the big decision needed to be made, a lot of times it would just be like me and him brainstorming. And so as far as the school stuff, when I finished high school, I took a year off. I applied to McGill, the University of Montreal, mm-hmm. where my parents had gone also. And I got accepted in physics. Actually, I got accepted into an honors program in physics, and I deferred for a year. And I thought, by that point, I was getting, you know, bookings as a DJ and whatnot. And I thought, all right, let me try to give this DJing thing even more time. And it's funny to think back because I realized that even during that time, that year was the wackest year of my career. When I had all the time in the world.
We're like, we're going to go for this.
Yep. It was just the year that I was least productive and the least focused. Huh. I lost a lot of focus when I had all the time in the world.
Why do you think that is?
I think I function better with structure and limits and constraints. Mm-hmm. When I only have 3 hours to make something work, I come up with my best work. Mm-hmm. If I have the whole day, I'm not lazy at all. Like any of my friends will say that I'm an obsessive worker, but my focus isn't the same. Mm-hmm. School gave me a sort of grid of time that I could work within and parts of the day that I couldn't work in. And also kind of like got my mind off of things mm-hmm. part of the day. So half of the day, my brain was, you know, in the atom. Mm-hmm. And the other half, it was on the record. So I took a year off. Wasn't that great? Then started my physics program at McGill. And, you know, during that first year, I think, is when I met Kanye. And he hired me to go on tour. And it was his first big tour as his album came out. And so I had to take a little bit of time off from a semester. And then I went back and like tried another semester. Yeah. And then there was another tour with Kanye. And by that point, it was becoming more and more of an on and off thing. But also, I could see the road of DJing, you know.
Like start to open up.
Open up even more. And I'd already been looking for some sort of like next chapter. Because like I mentioned, like the battle scene, the turntable scene, the sort of the scene that I first came up in was kind of falling apart or disbanding a bit. And I was the young one from that first run. So my whole thing was to find like the next avenue to keep, you know, to keep the flame alive and to show more people all these, you know, styles in DJing that my peers and I, my mm-hmm. friends and I had came up with during the battle years. So I was looking for some sort of break. And, you know, the Kanye gig felt like a break. I remember, you know, doing my first couple shows with him, which, you know, we were flying from the seat of our pants and literally we're not rehearsing and playing in front of, you know, huge arenas. And he would just kind of like give me notes after the show and be like, yeah, that part's cool. Or if I had an idea for a trick to do, because I had all these ideas, like, oh, I'm going to work in all the scratching in the show. He'd be like, all right, let's try the sound check. So we'd get like a 20-minute sound check. And I'd be like, what if we did this? And maybe it was an idea that was in my head that I didn't even try. And I would try it, and he would watch it and be like, yeah, let's do it. Or like, no, I don't like it. And I had to make sure that the idea was like as actualized as I could.
And then it was like in the audience the next time you tried
it. Literally, 100%. But I would, you know, it was such a jump up on every level from you know, what I was doing in prior years that I felt like this was where I needed to be. Uh-huh. You know, I was on that stage and showing, you know, turntablism to audiences that weren't familiar with it. And he helped sort of contextualize it, you know, and together we were able to like package it and present it to people that weren't familiar in the way that was like, hey, get familiar. Yeah. This is why it's dope. You know, like skills were celebrated on that stage. So once those early tours were happening, you know, I really felt like a sense of belonging, a sense of purpose there. And so, you know, after taking one or two semesters off of school, there was definitely that.
But the momentum was obviously like.
Yeah, there was the fork in the road of like, all right, am I going to continue trying to finish this physics degree? And as I was going further down the road in physics, like university level physics was a little bit less fun for me. Like, I really liked Newtonian physics. I liked explaining the world around me. Like, if I drop this cup, how far is the water going to splash? Like, I like that kind of stuff. Or like, you know, if I'm walking on an incline, what's the force on my muscles? Like, and doing math formulas, calculus, and getting an answer that circles back to the real world. Huh. Being like, oh, I crunched these numbers, and this is how far the apple's going to go. Like, I like that kind of thought process. The physics that I was doing in university was like astrophysics. Like, numbers that the human brain doesn't.
Just like invented crazy imaginary numbers.
Yeah, like just levels of like exponential this and that where I'd be like, I can't even picture this. Or going like literally inside the nucleus or inside the atom and just being like, I can't relate to this anymore. We're no longer talking about how far is the apple going to go. Like, I'm a little tuned out here. You know, it was just numbers, 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 numbers. So, you know, I was losing a little bit of interest there too, and there was a conversation.
Did you have a sense when you were... You know, in like that first year of college or going to college, where did you see, did you were like, oh, I'm going to be this type of physicist, or like, this is the kind of job I'm going to do if I go into physics?
To be fair, by the time I applied to college, I was getting a sense that the DJ thing could be a career, at least for a certain amount of time. And I wanted school to still be a part of my life because I enjoyed what it brought to my life. But I don't think I really wanted to be a physicist per se. I chose physics because I enjoyed those classes. Right. So I was definitely lucky to even be in that position to, and you know, this might sound crazy to, you know, what I would assume would be a mostly American listenership, to choose a program in school just almost for fun or just because like I like it. But please keep in mind that schools in Canada are dirt cheap. Yeah. You know, so you know, I was already. DJing was becoming my career. Going to McGill University, which is as good as any Ivy League, was dirt cheap. And so I chose a program that was just sort of a passion of mine. Awesome. Yeah, just something that you know, my mind enjoyed. But yeah, then it got to the point where I was like, all right, am I going to continue trying to finish this degree? You know, had the conversation with my parents. And, you know, Dave was sort of, again, part of the... Yeah. The sit down, and I, you know, he told my dad, he said, what Alain is doing in DJing now is extremely unique, and there's opportunities that are there now. School is something that we all valued in that household. My parents are intellectuals. My brother was, you know, studying literature himself. Mm-hmm. But there was definitely this sense of like, I could come back to this degree at another point in my life. This things, the openings that are happening on the DJ side are worth grabbing now.
Right.
So that was the decision there. That was just like, I could always come back to this stuff. Let me try to do this thing with my full attention.
Did you, when I was at Columbia, I'd see Dave in the architecture cafe.
Yeah.
Cause I think he was there to like tutor people in the French department or something like that. Or literature department?
Maybe, yeah. I also remember that he used to go and have lunch at one of the cafes that was like not his campus.
It was the architecture one.
Probably, yeah. I think because I would go meet him sometimes.
It was like under the building. It was like in the basement.
Yes. Yeah. I remember sometimes I would, whether it be before I moved to New York or even once I moved to New York and I was living in Brooklyn, he was all the way up there, uptown. Sometimes I'd just go meet him for lunch and we would have lunch there. Yeah. I think he just liked that cafe better.
It was the one, I think, not non-campus run one.
Yeah,
and okay. I think it was because it was in the architecture department. There were like funnier art kids hanging out there,
right? Okay,
and Dave still very much stood out, obviously, because his pants were like extra tight. And like, and I remember at that time, Chromio was already getting pretty big, so he would be known as the Chromio guy. That was
especially at like you know in cities like New York for sure.
But I guess I was curious, like, because obviously he was still pursuing also an academic interest.
Yeah.
Did you ever have the chance, because it sounds like he really stepped to the plate a bunch of times for you and kind of did you ever have a chance to like guide him through certain things?
Yeah, he really didn't want to stop his studies. And you know, I almost had to convince him that it was okay to stop his studies. Because once Chromeo took off, and then they were putting out, you know, entire albums, which is different from what I was doing on the DJing side. I would just go and play shows and another show and another show. But, you know, when you're a band and you make albums, the timing of the release of those albums is really sensitive, and he would have to work out that timing in relation to his school timing and work out tours in between school stuff. And
like big blocks you have to take off just to go tour around.
Yeah, or try to do the tours in the summer. And then if they weren't fully done with the album and they had this, like, firm, you know, date on the calendar that they had to hand in so that the album could come out, so that they could tour before the next semester started, it was tremendous stress for him because, you know, you're trying to create, and if you're not done with the music, then it feels like the whole world is going to crumble. So it got to a point where, you know, I remember we would sort of joke around, or I would joke around and tell him, like, for a long time people would say, oh, you do Chromeo? Wait, you're also pursuing a PhD? That's crazy. And there's a point where I told him, like, you know when people say that's crazy? It's actually literally crazy. Like, it's not just like a casual, that's crazy. It's like, this is destructive crazy. Like, this is not good. You shouldn't be doing this anymore. And, you know, Dave's the kind of person that, you know, he puts a lot of pressure on himself. And I think he almost imagines expectations that his loved ones have on him. He felt like he would be disappointing me, my parents, whoever else, if he stopped school. And my dad was, by that point, you know, and again, my parents are academics. My dad was like, you really should stop the school stuff. Like, this.
Like, what are you doing, Dave?
Yeah, because I think my dad, you know, Dave was studying literature. My parents studied literature, right? And I think my parents were looking at what Dave and I were already accomplishing with our music at a young age. And even just looking at Dave with Chromeo, making full albums that my dad could, like, listen to at home and be like, wow, my son made this. Yeah. And he was comparing that to whatever his own sort of self-reflective view of what he'd done in his life. And he'd be like, this is doper than academia, honestly. Like, it was wild for us to see our dad say that. It was
that's amazing.
It was really cool that he sort of came around to that and he said that. But yeah, meanwhile, Dave would just be like, no, I can't. I started this thing. I have to finish it. And, you know, we were kind of getting to a point, even in our age difference, where I was able to come in more and,
that's cool,
you know, yeah, and give him my advice. Because when we were younger, you know, it was more one directional. Yeah. You know, when I was 13 and he was 17, you know, I would just listen to him was that. But when we were both in our 20s, and even more so now that we're both in our 30s, well, he is 40 now. But yeah.
Happy birthday, Dave.
Yeah. Increasingly through the years, it's been really nice in our relationship to get to points where we could help each other out, and it became more of a two-way street.
Cool.
And I feel like those conversations, when he eventually stopped his PhD program before actually finishing his dissertation, you know, that feels like one of the first times where I felt like I was able to, you know, step in his life and be like, no, I don't agree with the path you're taking. Please listen to me. You really should just do that.
I guess it also helped that at that stage you'd been doing your pursuit for a little while.
Probably, yeah.
So I didn't realize it's almost 6:30.
Oh.
Which is rad, but also I feel like I need to wrap this up. Mm. So last question, which I think you maybe alluded to, but it's kind of the common question I've been asking people is,
okay,
when you, especially with the DJ stuff, when was the first time you made a dollar? When was the first time someone paid you to do what you did?
I mean, it was definitely, it was back in the Montreal days, you know, getting booked to do a quick little scratch showcase.
This is before you won the world championship.
But I'm trying to remember if it was before or after I won that first title, because I really won that championship pretty early on. But there must have been a show before I won that big battle where I must have gotten paid like $200 or something just to play at a show.
Do you remember having any idea, like any idea how to assess like what you were worth at that point, or like what your time was worth, or anything? You're like, cool, I'll take whatever.
Yeah, it was kind of I'll take whatever. And I think at that point, like, it was a small scene, it was a pretty small music community, and, you know, most favored nations kind of vibe. Yeah. Like, whatever the next guy is getting paid is fine. Yeah.
Sick. Well, thank you, A-Track.
Thanks.
Appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks.
Hope the Goldie Awards are rad.
Thank you.
That's this Thursday?
Thursday.
Cool.
Yep.
All right, thanks, man.
Thanks.
Oh, quick update on tomorrow. What's tomorrow? Totally blanking. Who's in tomorrow? So, so Bella, Food's very own Bella, is going to start off the day with Bella's morning opera show.
I'll tell you what it is tomorrow. You just have to tune in, but it's great. Of course.
Of course.
I'll probably only have time for the first act and the first part of the first act. If you guys are into some beautiful female soprano singing, ready to shed some tears, please tune in to the first half hour or so, because it happens to be one of my favorites.
And then at 12, two really good friends of mine from Berkeley days, actually went from architecture to now running a graphic design studio called Once Future, are here. And then at 1,
we have Alice Hines coming in. She's actually a good friend of mine, not from college, post college. She's a really brilliant writer, and also the kind of model freelancer, which I think is something that I'll ask her a couple of questions about. But she's here to do a reading of one of her articles. It's part of a post-college series that the New York Times commissioned, and she's writing about the trials of online dating.
And then after Alice, the artist Tim Simmons is here, who Bella introduced us to. Bella knows pretty well.
Yes. Share a few things.
And he'll be running an exquisite corpse workshop.
Yes.
Out of the office.
Yeah, it's there's some drawing involved. You will be mimicking each other, drawing onto different frames. I'll let him explain more about it tomorrow. But at the end of the day, we have an unbelievable session. Very excited. A packed hour with four Asian power women who are, and I hope I get this right, Su Chen, Nancy Wang, Hannah Cheng, and Sarah Law. And I think Nancy is she'll be on a little later than 5, but at least the Hannah, Sue, and Sarah will be here as of 5 p.m.
And across
tomorrow.
The four of them, they work in food, they work in fashion, right. They work in
music.
Design, music. So it'll be really interesting to just have them. And they're all friends, so yeah. They'll all just be talking to each other.
Yeah.
And hopefully we start tomorrow with good vibes. We'll see how the opera feels.
Oh, God, I just forgot about that. I was like, what are you talking about?
It's good fun.
Go vote if you haven't voted.
Yeah, go vote and stay strong. And we're all here for you if you want to come and cry or if you want to celebrate.
We might have an hour crying on air session.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Adria.
Bye.